You're listening to the City Gospel Movement's podcast, where we celebrate and accelerate collaborative gospel work in cities around the world.
We believe God is already at work in your city. We're here to help you ask, what is God doing where I live, and how can I join in?
If you love your city, love the church, and believe God can do amazing things in your city, you're in the right place.
Let's get started.
Very beginning, so let's plan the church with the non-Christians. Rather than sitting in the living room and trying to invent a sort of a church that would fit for the non-Christians, let's get them involved in the design beforehand. Now, they give us the best ideas.
Hey everyone, before we jump into the conversation with Raphael, which you are going to love, I mean, his French accent alone is great, we want to let you know of a great resource on the City Gospel Movement's website that we haven't let you guys know about yet. If you go to citygospelmovements.org and click on Get Equipped on the top navigation bar, you'll be able to access some groupings of best resources that we've compiled and curated just for you. You can look up topics around gospel movement basics, where we help give definition to what is a gospel movement. We also have a category on evangelism, where we've compiled some of our favorite resources on sharing the gospel and elevating the conversation on evangelism. And we also have some of our favorite resources on church unity. So check out citygospelmovements.org to access resources in the categories of City Gospel Movement Basics, Evangelism, and Church Unity.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks for joining us on another episode of the City Gospel Movement podcast. I'm Stephanie Weber, and today we have a very special guest all the way from France. And Raphael Ansberger is joining us. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Raphael.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Raphael, for those of you who don't know, is an evangelist. He's a speaker. He's an author. Has a passion to raise up the next generation of leaders. But he's also an adjunct professor of international studies at Columbia International University. He is the director of RZIM. In France for the French-speaking world. And he's also the president of France Evangelization and CEO of Global Evangelist Forum. He was also named the Billy Graham Lausanne Scholar for 2018, and he's married and has four kids and lives in the lovely town and city of Nice, France. So such an incredible resume, Raphael. So happy to have you join us. And I think it would just be really interesting for our listeners, myself included, to hear just as someone from France who lives there currently, who has a heart for evangelism in that country, what is it like? I think we have ideas of what Europe is like, kind of in a post-Christian, some people would even say post-atheist culture. What is it just like in your sphere of influence there in France?
Well, I must say this, is that living in France right now is, I think, the best time in the past 50 years when it comes to gospel engagement. We are now coming to what we call in sociology the second phase of secularization. That is, we've went all the way down the road of secularism and found that there's actually nothing there. And so today, more than ever, people are asking, again, the big questions. And so that's where we see tremendous fruit across Europe. People might be surprised to hear on the show that in France, currently, we're opening a new church every 10 days.
Wow.
And that's counting those we're closing. It's a net figure.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, a new church every 10 days. And Spain is opening a church every 3 days. So that just gives you an idea of the strength of the evangelical movement across Europe. Now, of course, depending on where you are, Scandinavia or the UK or Germany, Netherlands, they're still struggling with nominal Christians leaving the church. But basically, in countries where there was a strong Catholic influence, now you're going to places like France and it's only 6% of the French people attending the Catholic Church in Spain were around the same numbers, Italy, Portugal. So in a sense, the state church and the nominal Christian faith is basically gone. And what you're left with is a militant minority, either Catholic, Orthodox, or Evangelical, or Protestant. And the good thing is that we're seeing more and more interaction between those minorities, militant minorities, coming together, not only to think about how we can speak of one voice to ethical issues like euthanasia and the question of the sanctity of life, but also issues pertaining to missiology. How do we evangelize together? How do we make Christ known in unity? So it's a new day. It's a new world. It's a new Europe. And then if you add on the top of that, the fact that we have this migration wave coming from East Africa, from the Middle East. Just taking my church in Nice, it's a congregation of about 150 congregants every Sunday morning. And in that middle of the 150 people, you have got 50 Iranians who just showed up overnight, and they're coming to Christ. And so it's just a new Europe. It's a new day. And it's fascinating to see how the Holy Spirit is empowering his church to think creatively about missions and cultural engagement in this new age.
Yeah, I think I would be really interested to know just kind of that idea of what you mentioned earlier about walking down the path of secularization and realizing there's nothing there. Can you expand on that a little bit? And I know that you teach a lot of young people in the university, and how do you kind of determine that that's what's really happened?
So if you want to have a good description of secularism, you think about it as a parasite. The only reason why secularism is functioning is because it's feeding on religion, and more so on a sort of a state religion or a national religion. Once the state religion is collapsing, then there's nothing to feed on. And then
right.
The parasite dies.
The 6% that are still.
That's right.
Yeah.
For instance, if you take the story of France, already back in the Enlightenment, there was the struggle among the political leaders. How do we build a future for France and Europe, knowing that between the Catholic and the Protestants, they can't just get together, and Europe is at war. And it's not possible to build a society on religion because we're just too complex. So then out of that rose the idea of deism. Let's just start from the vantage point that there's a God, is the first architect, the first mover. There are many different theological persuasions, but let's not put those forefront in order to build society. And then you move into the 19th and the 20th century, and then the idea of God as a first mover is becoming even more exotic with thinkers like Nietzsche and Freud and Marx. So then when you come to the end of the 1900s, the idea of God is so foreign that it becomes a new idea for new people who want transcendence. And they've seen that actually living life without any transcendence, any ideas of God, and just in a pure immanent frame, as Charles Taylor would say it, it's just very difficult. There's some cross pressure when you live in this bubble where we tell you there's nothing outside of the imminent frame, nothing outside just what it is and what is there. And the young people who are born in those in this context, they're not mad people. They lift up their eyes and they're starting asking bigger questions and say, I think there's more to life than just what is told on movies and what I'm told at school. I think there's a bigger secret that nobody wants to talk about. And so that's where religions have an opportunity to come back on the forefront and say, yeah, let us tell you the story we forgot. Not because we don't want to hear it, but because we forgot about it. See, that's the big difference. When I'm talking with young people who are aged 30, 25 and under, it's not that they don't want to talk about God, it's that they forgot to talk about God. See, or they don't know how to talk about God when you don't even have any definition to start from.
Right. Is it that they've forgotten to talk about God, or the generation ahead of them has forgotten to talk about God?
The generation before them didn't want to talk about God.
Right.
So that's why they became Alzheimer, spiritual
yes.
Alzheimer on that very same category. But then the sons and daughters who are raised in this, they don't have any a priori ideas about religion. See, take for instance this survey that was done in 2010 in France and actually across Europe. Very interesting. We were asking kids who were 12, 13 years old, if I say the word religion, what comes to your mind? And across the spectrum in France, they said Islam. That's the thing that came to their mind when you say the word religion, okay? And then the second question is this something positive or negative? And they would say it's something positive. And then the next question was, why do you say it's something positive? And they say, well, at least the Muslim, they believe in something and they do something about it. They own it. Mm-hmm. And it's just not something pie in the sky. It's they do the Ramadan. They stick to their conviction. And as a generation who was raised in a pluralist context, we applaud the fact that you can be militant mm-hmm. and abide to your belief. And that was a complete shock.
Yeah.
Sociology didn't see that coming. But the fact is that the new generation is not relativist in a sense. They don't believe that things are equal in themselves. That might be a problem in the States, not a problem in Europe, because we understand that we can't all be true and saying the same thing at the same time. But they're a pluralistic generation in a sense. They understand that today there's no domination of any singular narrative. It's just a mosaic mm-hmm. of different narrative. Mm-hmm. And then religion and non-religious people have their place in this marketplace of ideas. And then it's a free place to travel and then discover and explore. So they want to know what are you talking about and why are you believing those things and what kind of difference that are making in your life, which is, you know, great opportunities for evangelists to strive.
Yeah, I think that study is so fascinating. And the idea that even in the States here, they're saying that this generation coming up, this Gen Z generation, is the first generation that will be kind of post-Christian, where they will not have touch points with the gospel, whereas the generations before that had at least gone to Sunday school, or maybe kids would go to a vacation Bible school or something like that. And so how do you see France in general, since you're the president and CEO of Evangelization for France, which is no small job, yeah. but how do you engage in that generation and that culture with the gospel, knowing what you know now about what they're thinking and how they're feeling? Well, how do you set a course to really engage with that culture?
The particularity of that new generation is that they want to see truth embodied in reality. So that means that we have to go beyond, as you know, Dallas Willard would say, the realm of the pure ideas. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for the generation before them, God was a pure idea. Like, I believe in God, but then there's reality. I need to wake up Monday morning. And I need to pay the bills.
Yeah.
So it was almost functional atheism. You know, I'm a Christian, but I function like an atheist.
Interesting.
And so this new generation will not buy into this, because they don't have time for pure ideas. I mean, it's just, it might be the gig of some, people who love philosophy and talking about, but they are busy about living in a world of crisis. Europe is in crisis. You've got the migration waves, you've got a stock of unemployment, you have the rise of nationalism. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's Brexit every day.
Right.
And so the question is, are we in, we're out, or what do we choose? So whatever you propose needs to be embedded in reality. Now, Lessinger begins said this thing. He said, for him, the only credible hermeneutic of the gospel for the 21st century is a church that believes in the gospel. And so that's very much what we're aiming at. As evangelicals in France, we are aiming to plant a church for every 10,000 people. So that means moving from 2,000 existing churches to 6,000 thriving churches, because it's only when they can have access to a local church where you have unity in diversity in community. Talk about 50 Iranians under the same roof with 20 more nationalities worshiping a same God under a same roof, multi-generations, that just blow your mind. Mm-hmm. You know, in a Europe that is highly divided and where you think that the only solution is either being pro-Europe or being a nationalist like Marine Le Pen. And then you walk into a building like this on Sunday morning, you see faith, hope, and love, unity and diversity and community, which is basically the project of the European fathers. And here you see that in concreto, with fellowship and love, then the young people, it doesn't take them too long to figure it out and mm-hmm. say, there's power in the message that is proclaimed and is embodied into the living community. And that's where the hermeneutic of the gospel stays and lays. So let's invest in our churches so that there can be beautiful pictures of what it means to be reconciled in God, through God, and be friends in Jesus and for Jesus to all nations.
So let's talk about that a little bit. How is that playing out in France as far as embodying the gospel in a wholehearted way, right? Instead of just on Sunday, and like you said, and Monday comes and it's a whole different story, right? So how are you kind of in France really trying to catalyze that in these existing 2,000 churches, but then to get to the 6,000?
Part of it is recovering for those churches the idea that if you want to be a hermeneutic of the gospel, you need to be in a place where you're seen. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that in France, for centuries, evangelicals were persecuted. Mm-hmm. So the idea to be visible was not there. It was a luxury. You had to hide because of your faith. And so we're moving from a ghetto mentality or persecuted minority mentality to a place where we're becoming visible. So it's a huge cultural trajectory for us to be visible and incredible in a sense. So today, when we think about church plant, we talk about those centers of influence in the city. You know, how do we live together and then embody the church in that very same place? We also are exploring new ways to be the church, and not just as a building, but as a community, mm-hmm. not just as a Sunday morning, but also as a everyday community living with one another for the sake of God and the world. So it requires us to play around with what we call this missional theology and explore what it means in terms of gospel and culture engagement, and then the forms of the church becomes then a vehicle to accelerate this cultural engagement, not as a prerequisite to what it means to be church. And so it's a kind of a Copernican revolution that we're going around. And there are very interesting ideas. I take, for instance, my good friend Tim and his team, who are church planting in the heart of the city of Lyon. If you walk into that church, what it looks like on an everyday week, it's a co-working space. It's a shared workspace. So you have three quarter of those who are actually renting a co-working desk mm-hmm. are non-Christian. Mm-hmm. So you have graphic designers, you have gamers, and very, very interesting crowd. But they start every morning and they finish every evening with prayer.
Wow.
See? So they start at 7 o'clock with a prayer meeting, and they end the day at 6:30 with a prayer meeting. And the beauty of it is that those who come to this place to work, they will stay an extra half hour at 6:30 to listen to how we finish the day as a church. And we ask this in a question about, where was God today? What did he show you? If it was to be done all over again, what would you different? So sort of a look back. And this new generation is always looking forward. They have an eschatology of progress. They don't know how to look back. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to mourn things that they should have done different. And so in community, they listen to that question, where was God today? And if it had to be done all over again, would you do things different? And they're just fascinated by the question. And then they say, well, can I share? And they're, sure you can share. And then at the end, and then we pray for them by name. And that's the first time that I am someone is praying mm-hmm. to God who I can't see, but it doesn't mean because I can't see that he's not there. And this God knows me by my name. I mean, talk about a huge Copernican revolution for them, you know, moving from the imminent to the transcendent. And then it's there, and it's in community through prayer, reading the Word of God, and then thinking about how do you live your life with God. So this is very powerful. And then on Sunday, they do happy hours, it's called, because it's downtown Lyon, so there's a lot of happy hours going around. And so they call the church service happy hours, and it's from 5 to 7. And so they move the desk around, and the co-working space becomes a chapel. You know, it's becoming a church, and they seat up to 70, 80 people in it. It's cram-packed, and they worship God, and you get the kids, and it's just a holy mess, in a sense, and a holy mass. And it's beautiful, it's chaotic, but it's in the everyday. You see what I'm saying? And that's the beauty of it, is that the people who were there on Monday, Tuesday, Friday, come back on Sunday with their not sure if I want to marry spouse or friend or partner, and then they start journeying together. So it's starting actually to act even as a Christian without being a Christian.
Exactly.
And being caught up into this habitus, social habitus, and then realizing that it's for me, and God knows me by my name, and he has a plan for me, and he loves me. And that's where, you know, as we continue to proclaim the gospel and walk with them, they're born from above, and boom, right there, it happens.
Well, I absolutely love that story. I mean, because it's redefining what church looks like, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's saying, listen, the chances of people walking in the doors are far less now today than they were, you know, how many years ago. So you're taking church to the people in the city. And you're finding that they're responding. And then they come back. And I think that idea of redefining what church looks like, would you say that that is something that is absolutely necessary for the church, the world evangelistic church, to move forward?
Absolutely. It goes even more than this. When we planted a church back 7 years ago in a place where even colleagues of mine who were church planters, I would never do this because this is such a hard place. And when you're talking about Freemasonry, you're talking about Mariology, you're talking about the world of occult, it was just really thick in terms of spiritual oppression. And when we started planting this church, from the very beginning, we said, well, let's plant the church with the non-Christians. Rather than sitting in the living room and trying to invent sort of a church that would fit for the non-Christians, let's get them involved in the design beforehand.
Crazy idea.
Now, they gave us the best ideas in terms of location, business plan, how to actually finance it, how to decorate it. And when you have, listen, when you have your non-Christian neighbor who helped you plan the church and brings his whole family plus the students from the class of his son and the teacher, and then he shares the gospel for you and say they need to come to church. As an evangelist, you look at this and say, am I living in a real world, or I'm just the only one to see that this is actually beautiful?
So beautiful.
It is, yeah. So some of them become evangelists even before being
right.
born again. So
yes.
It's just beautiful to see that it's a generation that if you take them seriously, they understand what you're here for.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I meet American missionaries coming to France and then hiding.
Right.
You know, and it's like, I'm here undercover and I'm teaching English lessons. I'm like, are you serious? Do you think we don't know what you're doing? Come on, you know, you live in you're living in this beautiful house, and you're telling me that you're just living because you give private English lessons, you know. And I said, you don't need to do that anymore. Just be you. You just say that the reason I'm here is for you to know the one who has changed my life. And as Europeans, we can understand that, you know, and just do your coming out as a missionary.
Exactly.
And consider that, yes, you have something to offer them, but they also have something to offer you.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
And that's how Jesus is also in the gospel story. It's just not monologue. It's actually, you see him being impacted by the non-Christians and challenged by the non-Christians. And it's a dialogue. Now, that doesn't mean that we're relativistic in the whole story. We know what the gospel is. But we welcome the fact that we want to journey with those who are struggling and seeking.
Oh, I absolutely love it. I mean, I think when you think about your job and encouraging evangelists in Europe and specifically in France, and this idea of kind of you know, like you were just mentioning the American missionary, like have a coming out party of, yep. you know, like, hey, I'm here. You don't need to hide.
Yeah.
How do you teach evangelists now differently than maybe you did when you first started? And what are you telling them and encouraging them to do, kind of similar maybe to this,
yes.
this American missionary? But, yeah. you know, are there things that people could really take away from this conversation? Like, if you did these three things, you would drastically change the way you see even just your profession as an evangelist.
It started actually by redefining 10, 15 years ago when we started the Global Evangelist Forum, redefining what is an evangelist. There's a yeah. lot of confusion out there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of confusion because there is some image in people's mind. So when you think about the evangelist, of course, you'll think about Luis Palau. You
right.
think about Billy Graham. And you think about the platform, male, more mature kind of evangelist. And so going back to scriptures, looking at Philip, the evangelist, and he's the only one called an evangelist, and see that, yes, he was doing mass evangelism in Samaria, but he was also doing one-on-one conversation with the Ethiopian eunuch and leading him to Christ all the way to the baptism, actually. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And then he went church planting in Caesarea, and he had four daughters who were prophets, and already four daughters is a nightmare, but then four daughters who are prophets and keep telling you what's wrong with your life, and I can't imagine the kind of conversation they had in home. Anyway, so, but the beauty of it is, if you look at Philip, diversity of expression of the ministry of the evangelist,
mm-hmm.
and the capacity also to give this passion to the next generation. And although his daughters were not evangelists, they were prophets, they were still in ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened within the context of home and church planting. So we clarified that, you know, what is an evangelist? And from scriptures, we made the case. And if auditors want to know more about that, they can find the book, Rediscovering the Ministry of the Evangelist. It's a book that summarizes about 10 years of research on the ministry of the evangelist, rediscovering the ministry of the evangelist. And clarifying already what it is, it's male and female. It's not mm-hmm. just male, it's male and female. And actually, I tell you what, the best evangelists we have in France right now are female evangelists.
Thank you very much.
I tell you what, I mean, they give lessons to those guys who think they know it all. I mean, I have girls in our programs. They are in their 20s.
Yeah.
For holidays, they go to Indonesia and they help rescue girls who are mm-hmm. sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do for their holidays, you know, mm-hmm. and they're full-time engineers. I've got another one. She moved into North Africa when she saw the Arab Spring because God said, who will I send? And she said, mm-hmm. here I am, I'm sending me. So she moves there as a single girl, and she's now pioneering a network of evangelists across the North Africa peninsula. So I'm just rejoicing in this,
yeah.
in the fan.
You're a fan.
I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. And I would really want to be challenged from scriptures, from people who say you can't make the case. In the book, it's very clear that it's male and female. If you want to debate on that, for me, just invite me. We'll have a good conversation.
We'll give everybody your website.
So first is, out of the three things you mentioned, first is clarifying what is an evangelist, what it's not. And second is welcoming the different kinds of evangelists, expressions of the ministry of the evangelist. We have new kinds of evangelists today, those who are very well at ease with the social media, and they use that. So we call them internet evangelists. Oh, you didn't find that in scriptures. You know, they didn't have social media. They had tablets, but you know, they didn't have social media. So it's a new kind. And so we welcome that. And we say, okay, how can we help you be better evangelists in your field? And the third is to recreate the link that has been broken for 2,000 years of church history between the ministry of the evangelist and the local church.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons I can't go into details, but I go into the book, the evangelist was always not well received within the church, and he had to reinvent himself into all the kinds of structures, and the Luis Palau or the Billy Graham or the crew. It's perfect examples of those parachurch ministries that were created by evangelists outside the realm of the local church because the pastors didn't really understand what it was mm-hmm. all about. And so you see now this sort of tension, sometimes destructive tension between evangelistic ministries and then local churches, and how do we come together? I think that's what you are all experiencing with the City Gospel Movement that started in Portland. And by the way, if you haven't read Kevin's book, Unlikely, you need to read it. It was one of the best book I read last year. Fantastically brilliant writer, very poetic, and I love just the way he talked about this very unlikely journey. And that's part of it, is how do we reconcile evangelistic ministry with local churches, so that we have gospel engagement within the city. And part of the challenge is to say to the pastors, evangelists are not just all affiliated with the Luis Palau NGA network. Mm-hmm. They're also in your church.
That's right.
And they're male and female. And what are you doing for them? And so the book, Rediscovering the Ministry of the Evangelist, was also written for the pastors as sort of a guidebook about how do you spot them in your congregation? How do you train them? How do you release them? And listen to this. Studies have shown time and time and time again that there's a direct correlation between your capacity as a church to recognize the ministry of the evangelist in your midst and revivalism. Hmm. Or evangelistic impact. It's a one-to-one correlation. In all the churches that we've been helping in this process, in this journey, once they have released the evangelist that Jesus himself gave to their church, the missional and evangelistic impact has been correlated to the same degree. And so it's not rocket science. Are you longing for your church to be evangelistic driven, and then recognize those that Jesus already gave you and sitting in your pews, and they wouldn't even call themselves evangelists. And it's also our role to say, let's clarify the lines, let's welcome the diversity, and let's release the gifting in the local church.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I come out of the tech background, and oftentimes in tech, you would find people that are those top-end thinkers and the ones that would create the next big thing. And companies were always trying to figure out, how do we keep them here in our organization instead of going out and doing their own thing, right? We want to keep that technology in our space. And I think sometimes there's this idea of infusing this evangelist inside your community to then be catalytic in your community, right?
But we Absolutely.
Don't, but if we don't help rise them up and show them kind of this opportunity inside to be able to be that person, then, you know, then we've missed that whole opportunity to just, you know, infuse others with these ideas of you can go share your faith and you can live out your faith and
Absolutely.
You can do it.
It's a sleeping giant,
yeah.
You know, we say often when we organize those forums, and it's beautiful when we see colleagues, pastors who are engaging with that challenge and then seeing the impact of it. Now, of course, it's always the same thing. You know, whenever you have an evangelist, I always have something to say about everything. You know, we should be more evangelistic. And why is it that we still have empty chairs? And why on earth are not everybody sharing their faith? And we know that, you know, we know that they're really obnoxious, you know, sometimes.
Right.
But it's because the evangelist was given to the church to be particularly concerned about evangelism.
Right.
Like theologians, they're always concerned that people read their Bible better, you know, and so the evangelist is given to the church so that we would share our faith more effectively. So in a sense, the Global Evangelist Forum and this network of evangelists that we have started with the Luis Palau and other organizations is here to help local churches and evangelists understand who they are, and how they can actually serve the church better by being what they are called to be in the midst of God's people. And it's a discussion, you know, that Billy Graham had already back in the 1980s with the Amsterdam conferences. Mm-hmm. It's a generation that we're starting again, because for every generation we need to recover the ministry of the evangelist. In a sense, you know, John Calvin would say in his institute, all the pastors and the theologians and the elders, we'll always need them. But the evangelists, you know, we'll see. It's an exceptional gift in a sense that it might not be necessarily every time. We say, no, we need it every day. And especially today in a post-secular society, that's where you really want them to to help the local church make sense of how you can be an hermeneutic of the gospel for a generation that is looking for him and don't know where to find him.
Yeah. So, Raphael, what are you dreaming about? Like, when you think about, you know, the next years, the next 5 years, 10 years, what are you dreaming that will happen? And what are you kind of pointing yourself towards as far as that big idea?
Part of the ministry of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries is going to places where the church is not yet. Yeah, and one particular place is the fashion industry. Hmm. And that's been on my heart for quite a while. And it's interesting because we see now more and more evangelical leaders who are involved in the field of the fashion industry, and they are praying for the fashion industry. It's actually, God is the first designer when you think about it. Mm-hmm. That's how he started. It started with a sacrifice. Think about it. Human beings are the only one who wear clothes. Animals don't, they don't spend hours, you know, in front of their, every morning say, I just wonder what I should wear today. I mean, that is the luxury of human beings. Why is it that we love clothes? Why do we love design? Why do we love fashion? Why do we feel the need to cover our body? Wow. Talk about a conversation for today. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to see more and more evangelists in the fashion industry, either on the models side or the design or the business side, thinking about how can we rediscover the beauty of the image of God within the fashion industry. How do can we go in a different way, not to abuse people in this sector, because I tell you what, I mean, if you look deeply into the industry, you will find a lot of abuse, a lot of slavery. Mm-hmm. It's really sad.
That's and, a lot of hurt and pain. Too.
And a lot of hurt and pain, mm-hmm. and we don't need to go there. I'm thinking of Tatiana Hoffman. She started an agency in London called There Is Hope, mm-hmm. TIH. And the idea started when one day she was walking in the street and she saw those homeless people, and she saw in them the image of God, and she saw in them models. Mm. And she approached them and she said, would you like to be a model? That's an interesting conversation.
Probably the last thing they would have ever imagined.
And now she got 5 models who are coming from the street.
Wow.
And 2 of them walked for the Bethany Williams collection in the London fashion industry early 2019. And Bethany Williams received the Queen Elizabeth II Award.
Wow.
And she's part of the 6 finalists for the Louis Vuitton Prize. And you're talking about 2 of the models of Tatiana walked, and they were paid the same amount of money as the models who are, you know, first page
right.
of Vogue magazine.
Right.
There is hope. You know, there is hope. And for those who are interested in listening to the program and to invest with us in that field, let's just recover the image of God in the world of fashion industry, because we have something to say. God has something to say. He's the best and the greatest designer. He's the one who covers our shame and fear and sense of guilt by covering it with the blood that will wash away every single sin. And that's good news for the industry. That's good news for all those who are struggling with identity, struggling with gender issues. God has still something to say to the fashion industry. So that's one particular segment where I'm praying for a rise of forces to help us proclaim the beauty of the gospel in this place where it's so needed.
Well, that's beautiful. And I hope that we can kind of follow along and see what God's doing in that space for you. So if people want to get hold of you and just see what you're doing, and clearly you're a scholar and the books that you've written, how would people get a hold of you, Raphael?
There's the RZIM website, which is the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry, rzim.org. And then rzim.fr, which is the French side of it, but it will be in a strange language called French. but also
test your sophomore year of French.
Everybody. Here we go. Yeah. Yeah, you need to get back at it. But also, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, and you can find me easily there, and I'll be very happy to respond to any inquiries you have.
Well, Raphael Anzenberger, thank you so much for joining us all the way from France. It was just a true delight to be with you today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Wasn't that such a great conversation with Raphael? I loved hearing those stories. Before we let you go, we want to remind you, check out citygospelmovements.org and click on the Get Equipped tab, where you can access some of our favorite curated resources in the topics of gospel movement basics, evangelism, and church unity. We're here to support you, so check out citygospelmovements.org and click on Get Equipped.
Thank you for listening to the City Gospel Movement's podcast, where we celebrate and accelerate collaborative gospel work in cities around the world. For more resources, show notes, and to get connected to gospel movements around the globe, visit citygospelmovements.org. That's citygospelmovements.org. Keep believing in what God can do in your city.